I'm going to now introduce our speaker, Eleanor Morley. Eleanor today is speaking on the theme Greed is Good, the Theory and Practice of Neoliberalism. Eleanor is a socialist alternative member in Sydney and is studying in the field of political economy. So please make Eleanor welcome.
All right, so while I think that there is mostly agreement amongst the left on the kind of how destructive neoliberalism, so the term referring to the form that capitalism has taken for the past 30 to 40 years, how destructive this has been to the world's global working class, there has been some pretty serious debate about the origins of neoliberalism and exactly what it is over the years. And the reasons why these debates are important are because the competing ideas of neoliberalism then lead towards different political conclusions. So has capitalism fundamentally changed? Why does it matter if it has or it has not? And what way can we resist the neoliberal onslaught that continues today? So with this talk, I want to first explain why neoliberalism came about, then discuss its implementation in different parts of the world, the way that it later consolidated itself, and finally finish with a discussion about neoliberalism in the post-GFC world and the various cracks and crises that have been developing in recent years. So first with the origin. So neoliberalism first started as a response to the global economic crisis that hit in the early to mid-70s. So this crisis followed a 30-year period of unprecedented economic growth. So this was the post-war boom that characterised that whole period between the 1950s through to the 1970s. So an enormous amount of state spending on the kind of global war machine was able to hold up the economy in all the kind of key economic regions of the world and allowed for the kind of expansion. Well, that coupled with an increasingly kind of militant and confident working class allowed for the construction of the welfare state as it used to exist, as well as relatively low levels of unemployment. So this all came crashing down in the 70s, where a crisis of profitability was coupled with an organised and militant working class that was not ready to concede defeat with the onset of that crisis. So the turn to what is now called neoliberalism began in the late 70s, but then really kind of took off under the regimes of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. And I think, in short, it was a wholesale class attack that existed to try and shore up profits at the expense of the wages and living conditions of workers in an economic context where there's not suddenly not as much money as there previously had been to kind of share around. So the first stage of neoliberalism, its implementation, I think is described, I think, quite aptly by Naomi Klein as a period of shock therapy. And this mostly took place throughout the 1980s and then also in the early 90s. So it took on a somewhat different form in different countries, but I think as a whole combined two basic components. So the first was an attack on the working class to increase the rate of exploitation, and there's a bunch of different features of this. So one was the taking on of organised labour right around the world. So there's a few kind of quite well-known moments where this happened. So Thatcher's battle with the National Union of Miners in England that went on for over a year, Reagan attacking the air traffic controllers and ending up just sacking hundreds of them to dismantle what was one of the kind of strongest fighting unions in the US at that time. And in Australia, a slightly different form with the Prices and Income Accord, which was implemented by a Labor government with the acquiescence or more than acquiescence. It was cheered on by the trade union bureaucracy, but ended up having that same effect to crush the militant working class that had fought for and won a whole series of things in the late 60s and early 70s. So another aspect of this class attack was the cutting of social welfare, which is something that I'm sure everyone knows a lot about. Education was free decades ago in Australia. Now it costs many tens of thousands of dollars just to get a basic degree. You can see similar things happening with healthcare, also the way that people receiving social welfare benefits are increasingly treated like criminals and forced to live well below the poverty line. There was also a restructure. There has also been a restructuring of tax codes so that, in general, the poor have to pay a greater share of their income towards taxation and the rich pay less. Malcolm Turnbull's currently trying to make them pay even less in Australia right now. Another significant thing was a rise in the rate of exploitation in workplaces around the world, which took place through pay cuts and also increases in productivity. So making people work harder, faster, for longer hours for the same, if not less, pay. There also was some offshoring or the or relocating industry to poorly unionised sections of a country. So in America, from the what's now termed the Rust Belt down to the South, which was poorly unionised, so that bosses could get away with paying workers less in the form of wages and forcing worse conditions on people, because they did not have to confront militant unions that would try to defend those rights. So the second basic feature of neoliberalism has been a restructuring of capital in the context of those low profit rates coming out of the crisis and also increased international competition between these big mega corporations. So within that, there's been large privatisations of state-owned assets, which has allowed for a few different things. First of all, it's a pretty big gift from the state to industry. They were often sold off at pretty low prices and essentially just give one capitalist a monopoly or a couple of people major control over what are essential features of the economy. Also encouraged an employer offensive on wages and conditions in those industries without the government being held to account politically, because it's now bosses over in the economic sphere doing this rather than politicians in the political sphere. Though it's worth saying that some state-owned industries were purged in this way as well. There's also been the deregulation of financial markets that allowed for the casino-like trading that all became exposed with the onset of the global financial crisis a decade ago, and the removal or reductions of tariffs, so what is kind of termed as free trade, to benefit some capitalists around the world, but also at the expense of others. And the tariff question is something that I'll address a bit more later in light of the past few weeks. Also, there was a purge of unprofitable industries to help kickstart the next round of accumulation. So this most famously happened with the Volcker shock, where the chairman of the Federal Reserve in the US sharply rose interest rates to a peak of 21.5% in 1981. So by doing this, they raised the cost of capital, thus forcing unprofitable industries to shut down and to allow the remaining ones to buy up their resources on the cheap. And this also had the effect of leading to a rise in unemployment, again, weakening the bargaining power of labour. So all of these various attacks and cuts were and still today are underpinned and justified by the neoliberal ideology that free markets will foster greater economic activity, which then in turn results in higher rates of growth, then coming trickling down to the rest of society. So it's like a rising tide lifts all boats. Clearly this is pretty rubbish. If you've read one of the many, many, many articles that seem to be flooding the media in recent years about the extreme levels of inequality, also the the massively expanding profits of corporations and private wealth of the ruling class compared to people having stagnating or falling wages, finding it harder to buy a house, etc. You can see it's pretty clear that the rich getting richer has remained just that. It's not allowed for the rest of us to get richer as well. So the first kind of showcase of neoliberalism happened in Chile. And I think it's quite significant that this followed or was only instituted by Pinochet's barbaric coup in 1973, which slaughtered a left-wing government as well as tens of thousands of workers who had reached a high level of militancy, were taking on the Chilean capitalist class, but were then drowned in blood by Pinochet, the Chilean bosses, and backed by the US. So a few years after the coup, Milton Friedman, who's one of the most famous neoliberal ideologues, was kind of shipped into Chile along with his Chicago boys, who were the economists that he'd trained in his theories in the his economic department at, in Chicago. And they were appointed as key economic advisors within the state, and then also they also set up a new department of the university there in Chile to train more and more people with the same methods. So neoliberalism was then unevenly taken up throughout the rest of the Western world. And then also following on from that, imposed on workers in the developing world. So again, this is in the context of the crisis of profitability, which led states in the developing world to look to international financial organisations like the IMF and the World Bank for loans, which resulted in enormous amounts of sovereign debt that were paid for by the working classes of those countries. So the politicians and the ruling class within the developing world kept a pretty decent standard of life, but neoliberal conditions were attached to the loans that forced a relaxation of labour laws, further privatisations, and also pretty severe austerity to hold down the national debt. All right, well, now I just want to take up one of the... what I think are the common, one of the most common misconceptions about neoliberalism, and that is the question of the state and what role the state has to play within this kind of economic setup. So, I mean, if you've done any humanities subjects at a university for the past 10 years, you most likely will have learnt that neoliberal doctrine is primarily based on the idea of reducing the size of the state and replacing it with the independent rule of the free market. I think this is wrong. I think that neoliberalism should instead be better understood as a reorientation of the state's activities in even greater favour of capital. And you can see this in a few different ways. So first of all, there's actually been an increase in the size of the state when taken as the amount of state spending compared to the GDP of a country. So with the privatisations, that did not mean that state money stopped going into those industries. Instead, they were marketised and then kind of massive handouts went along with them. So in Australia, even in the past few years, starting with the Liberal government in 2014, they privatised a whole series of state-run welfare services like women's shelters, a bunch of different disability services, boarding houses for children without parents or children that have been taken away from their parents by the state. But then they give these massive cash handouts to the people who are running those industries. There's also been the enormous bailouts that started in the 1980s with some of the key corporations in the US. And then more extremely in the way that governments responded to the global financial crisis by just handing out insane amounts of money to financial corporations and banks. And there's also been a massive increase in the security apparatus and surveillance of the state. So one of the most kind of famous instances of this is the crime bill that Bill Clinton enacted in 1994, which has directly led to the obscene rates of incarceration that you can see in the US today. It has the highest rate of incarceration of any country in the world. But also in other things, like I think the increased militarization of the police force, something that, again, is just taking place in Victoria right now, to further enable the kind of violent wing of the state to crack down on any resistance. So I think it's also significant that the implementation of neoliberalism didn't just happen overnight or in the space necessarily of a couple of years, nor did it nor was it rolled out evenly around the globe. So there was no original master plan implemented uniformly around the world by just a small group of neoliberal ideologues, which is the way that this argument is often presented. So it wasn't a totally kind of random occurrence. The term neoliberalism does have its roots in a group of bourgeois economists dating back to Central Europe in the 1930s. Back then they were called the Ordo-Liberals and organised in the Mont Pelerin Society, if anyone's heard of that. And they developed the neoliberal doctrine. So what that stated was that the state should seek to construct the ideal foundations for a free market as the optimum way of organising human society. So there's nothing natural about the market, but it's very good for the rich and the ruling class. So the point of the state should be to try intervene into the economy and society to allow for that to happen. So these ideas were also transplanted to the US through Hayek and Friedman, who I mentioned before. But there's a whole series of different economic theories and ideas that can be developed. But the question we need to ask is, why did this one take hold? It wasn't just because people like Hayek got into the ear of the right politicians at the right time. I think it's more because it actually fits with the needs of capital at the time. So the crisis of profitability had led the capitalist class to be much more hostile to the relatively high wages that workers had and the social spending of the post-war boom. So these attacks on organised labour, attacks on conditions in the workplace and living conditions actually fit very well with their desire to maintain their own profit rate at the expense of workers. Another indication of the kind of less organised aspect of neoliberalism was that Margaret Thatcher, who really is kind of the most famous face of this whole political and economic process, was originally a political outsider within the Tories. She was not just kind of swept up to the head of that party and into office after having won this whole party to exactly what she was arguing for. And also the small steps that were started by the state then created new steps. So it's like removing one set of capital controls or something like that, then put pressure on others. So it created its own momentum in that way, like a snowball effect. And I think that that debate is important to understand because the conclusion of it is, if there was just a few ideologues who won over the right politicians, then the way we can challenge neoliberalism is to get a different, correct set of politicians into the state to turn back all these gains. But I think seeing neoliberalism as something that is embedded much beyond that, a few individual politicians, it's actually embedded in the whole way that capitalism has been organised for the past 40 years, means that we need a different, I think much more radical strategy to challenge its impacts. All right, well, I want to move on to talking about the kind of second stage of neoliberalism or its consolidation around the world. So this mainly happens in the 1990s and the first bit of the 2000s. So the early 1990s saw the consolidation of neoliberalism as just the hegemonic global economic and political strategy. When the Soviet Union fell in Eastern Europe, it was a neoliberal strategy that was immediately implemented throughout most of those countries. Also, every branch of various states as well as university economics departments, became filled out with neoliberal economists and ideologues. There was no room for kind of debate with some old Keynesians or anything like that. It was all thoroughly neoliberalised. So Neil Davidson, who has written quite extensively on neoliberalism, talks about this term social neoliberalism, and I think this is the main way that it became consolidated. So what this refers to is the neoliberalisation of what were the traditionally social democratic parties. The most stark example of this, I think, is New Labour in the UK under Blair. So the social part refers to an easing of some of the social conservatism of people like Thatcher and Reagan, but maintaining the same kind of hardline economic approach. Thatcher actually once kind of wryly commented that Tony Blair and New Labour were her greatest achievements. Okay, so what did this lead to? Well, first of all, I think it helped gain the support of a slightly larger section of the population, so people who felt financially secure, the middle class, kind of liberal intelligentsia, etc., for neoliberal counter-reform. So they could still be pro-women, pro-LGBTI, but also were not having their kind of economic conditions attacked. But I think more worryingly, it also led to the kind of acceptance of the trade unions, that this was just the way that society is now organised, and there is no point in mounting a serious challenge to that, because what that would have meant was mounting a challenge to the parties which the trade union bureaucracies have attached themselves to. So the Labour Party in Australia, the UK, etc. Also, the convergence of the major parties has created even more of a disconnect between the state and the population. And there's a whole bunch of different ways you can see this. There's been a huge decline in popular participation in the political process. So party membership is at record lows. The amount of activists organising within political parties is also very low. And voter turnout has just been crashing year after year, with some bounces back, but generally at a pretty steep decline. And most of the elections that have happened over the past 2 years continue to reflect this. Okay, before moving on to the kind of more modern aspect of neoliberalism, I just wanted to pause to take stock of what the results of this whole process have been. So I already spoke about the political participation side of it. But I think one of the worst has just been the global inequality that kind of increases quite shockingly every single year. So people might have seen that since 2014, Oxfam has started publishing reports on the state of global inequality. And what they've reported since then is that every year since it began, half the world's wealth has become concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. So I think when they started it, it was about 82 people own the same amount of wealth as the poorest 50% of the global population. And the most recent report that came out, I think in February this year, shows that that figure is now 8 individual people. So it's quite an astonishing concentration of wealth in fewer and fewer hands. Well, the other result has just been the conditions for workers around the world. So the counter-reforms in the workplace have wound back most of the gains that the labour movement won in the late 60s and 70s. So wages are stagnating in some countries, have been on a slow decline. The rate of exploitation has increased dramatically, and conditions at work have gotten increasingly worse. So most people will know that a lunch break is now pretty much a thing of the past. People have to sit at their desks and continue working while they quickly shove down some food. Things like penalty rates are being eroded, as well as others. There's also been an explosion in household debt. So part of that is the size of mortgages that people have to take out, But it's also people having to rely on credit. As commodities, housing, utilities get more expensive, but wages do not rise to match that. People are forced to rely more and more on credit, which obviously comes attached with it, very high interest repayments. Finally, and I think this is the result of this period that has kind of the most serious political consequences for us today, is the historically low rate of union membership and strikes. So in Australia, Tom Bramble reported in a Marxist Left Review article earlier this year that only one out of every seven workers is now in a union. And for context, in the early 1980s, this ratio was one in every two workers. And this kind of low rate of unionisation has made it easier for bosses to continue to ramp up their attacks, which in the past couple of years have started more and more taking on the form of just ripping up enterprise agreements to install massive, massive pay cuts and so on. There's another debate I wanted to take up as well, which is the question of resistance. So it is undeniably true that there is, as I just said, there are less strikes, there are less sustained political movements and political struggles today than they were a few decades ago. But the kind of trade union leadership, the social democratic parties, and a whole series of political theorists argue that this is because it's impossible to resist in the old way. The old way meaning organised industrial action. So I think there's two main arguments that tend to come up alongside this. So the first is that it's changes in industry, so things like offshoring, automation, casualisation. It's these things that have created an increasingly precarious and underconfident working class that is no longer willing to fight. I think the other argument that tends to come up is that now we're just all far too atomised. So mass consumerism, smartphones, these sorts of retreats into the self and individualism have made collective resistance something that is essentially impossible. So I'll address each of those arguments in turn. First of all, with the changes in industry, it is the case that a lot of the changes are actually quite overstated. So with offshoring, it's true that some industries in the kind of advanced capitalist countries have moved overseas, mostly like low-skilled, labour-intensive, simple production. But the bulk of this shift actually took place before the neoliberal era. And changes in the composition of industries and workforces are just a constant under capitalism. The workforce in, or the workplace in the 1970s and industry in the 1970s looked very different to how it did in the 1910s, etc. So for the most part, workers in the Western world have not lost their jobs directly to developing countries. Firstly, it's actually not that simple to just pick up these enormous amounts of fixed capital, like factories, etc., and just simply move them overseas. Most relocation of industry, like I said earlier, has taken place within countries, so from well-unionised areas to poorly unionised areas. Also, there has been a decline of the kind of overall numbers of jobs in certain industries, or the like relative amount of jobs in certain industries. So like manufacturing and the wharves in Australia are an example, which is terrible for the people and the families who have lost those jobs. But it doesn't actually reduce the economic power of the remaining workers. If you've just got 20 people operating one workforce instead of 200, those 20 people going on strike can still shut it down in the way that those 200 previously could. But alongside this, so the loss of the relative loss of jobs in manufacturing, or the kind of what people understand as the traditionally blue-collar jobs, has gone alongside a rise in service work. And I think it's just wrong to say that these workers can't be unionised. There's some examples, pretty inspiring examples, of incredibly precarious workers starting to organise and fight. So There's a bunch of examples, but I think Uber drivers in London are an interesting recent example of that. So I think instead the decline in union militancy and collective action is more the result of a problem with political leadership. The Social Democratic Party's accepted, or in the case of Australia, actually implemented neoliberalism, and the trade union leadership make very few attempts to organise workers or politically challenge the kind of dominant neoliberal thought that exists amongst the Social Democratic parties. Oh, yeah, and secondly, on the atomisation thing, well, this isn't a new argument. Like in the 50s, the argument was with the now that everyone has a TV in their house, there will never be any collectivity again because people want to sit on the couch and watch TV shows instead. What came after the 50s? The 60s and 70s, which saw a mass explosion of collective action right around the world. And I think today that this argument has been disproved by the quite tumultuous social movements that we've seen over the past 5 years. So while they've not mostly yet taken the form of long sustained industrial action or even long sustained social movements, you can see that there is still this desire to fight back against the conditions that have been imposed on people, and there's still a drive for people to come together and do that collectively. I think the West Virginia teachers' strike and the upcoming one in Oklahoma is a really inspiring recent example of that. Okay, I'll move on to talking about what I think is the third stage of neoliberalism. So the global financial crisis that hit a decade ago, and then its ramifications. So neoliberalism could not actually prevent the inbuilt tendency to crisis that is built within capitalism. So it did allow for a partial recovery of the rate of profit, mainly due to the increased exploitation of the working class, but this this obviously did not last. So profit rates started to fall again from the mid-90s, again unevenly in different parts of the world, but this process set the stage for the crisis that hit or ruptured in 2007 with the subprime mortgage crisis in the US that then precipitated the whole global economic crash in 2008. So for a time, people thought that 2008 marked the death of neoliberalism, proved that it cannot sustain itself as an infinitely expanding economic system, but it actually managed to claw on quite successfully. There was a very neoliberal response to that crisis. So first of all, I think the massive corporate bailouts are an indication of that. The figure that I've found for this is that in the US, $23 trillion was spent on bailing out the financial institutions, the banks, etc. Not a cent of that was spent on bailing out families who are having their homes foreclosed and forced to live in new tent cities in parking lots. The other kind of neoliberal side of the response has been global austerity. So worse in some places than others, but essentially just trying to remove the last remaining aspects of the welfare state, increase the pension age while decreasing pension payments, cutting spending on healthcare and education, trying to just rip up remaining labour codes, etc. But all of this in turn has also produced resistance. So there was the Occupy movement in 2011, We Are the 99%, You Are the 1%, etc. There were a whole series of general strikes in Greece, the Indignados movement in Spain, etc. Okay, but I'll start to conclude by talking about the situation today, or the crisis that, somewhat of a crisis that has developed in neoliberalism. So I think the past 2 years have seen some serious cracks appearing in the neoliberal consensus of the past 30 to 40 years. And this has kind of happened most seriously in the two historical hearts of capitalism, so the US and the UK, both of which have suffered severe political shocks for the ruling class over the past 18 months. So this crisis comes from the end result of first of all, just decades of neoliberalism and what its effects have been, but overall the harsh austerity that people have been facing for what is now a decade, and also the fact that the economy globally is still just only kind of sluggishly recovering and has not managed to pick back up in any serious way. So I think it's hard to say exactly how this will play out because we are still in the process of this crisis unfolding, but I've got some series of thoughts. So I think there's two aspects to the crisis, the first of which is the popular rejection of neoliberalism. So most neoliberal measures have actually always been unpopular, so things like regressive taxation, privatisations and so on have not just been kind of cheered on and championed by workers around the world. But I think that's increased because now they've proven, these measures have proven to actually have just totally failed. So neoliberalism over the past 10 years has shown that it can't bring the goods economically as well as politically. And I think the massively positive response to some of Corbyn's platform is an indication of this, like renationalising some important sections of British industry. There's also been a fall and in some places total collapse in support for the parties or the traditional parties of the centre, which have been deemed to be responsible for the neoliberal measures of the past 30 years. So this all started up in Greece and Spain and some other countries a few years ago, but now it's moved to the UK, the US, and the kind of heart of Western Europe. So phenomena like the rise of Bernie Sanders, the mass support for Jeremy Corbyn, the Brexit vote, the election of Trump, these are all kind of, in their own way, different phenomena. I think it's wrong to just try to put them under the kind of catch-all umbrella of some sort of populism, which has been done by the liberal media. But I think I don't have time to go through all of them separately, but I think that they do all in some way represent a popular rejection of neoliberalism. So the second aspect of the crisis is that it has it's taken hold amongst a small section of the ruling class. So I think that there's a growing section of the ruling class and their advisers that can see there's a rocky road ahead, partly because of that popular rejection and the political impacts that that's having, but also just the general sluggish growth that I mentioned before existing alongside the quite astonishing rise of China, which is more and more being seen as a serious threat to Western capitalism through its kind of rapid economic growth and also increasing military power. But the thing that kind of holds this back is that no one has produced an alternative road ahead for the global economy. So a kind of turn to economic nationalism is filling that gap a little bit for some, but it's still been overwhelmingly rejected by the ruling class. So you can most see it in Trump, I think, in a few different stages. So on his campaign trail, I think in order to really try win votes in the deindustrialised Rust Belt, he spoke a lot about bringing American manufacturing back on shore or recreating American jobs for American workers, and also criticised previous administrations quite a lot for focusing too much on bolstering international markets rather than domestic ones. Then upon first taking office, he publicly ripped up the TPP negotiations, which didn't have a serious direct effect on the economy because it's something that hadn't yet been enacted, but it was, I think, a serious symbol that he was not, or he didn't plan to just kind of oversee the international financial order in the exact same way as his predecessors. And then obviously recently there's been the actual new set of tariffs on imports that are designed overwhelmingly to affect China. So on these tariffs, so far it's been a 25% tariff on steel, a 10% of aluminium, and $60 billion worth of tariffs on other imported Chinese goods. I don't think that this the strategy for this is a serious redirection of the American economy. America doesn't actually get most of its steel and aluminium from China. I think it's more of a political statement and a step in the direction of gearing up for some sort of confrontation with China. But in saying that, it is a break with the direction of kind of the leaders of Western capital for quite some years. Despite these kind of shifts coming from a section of the ruling class, I think overwhelmingly their attitude can be characterised as one of continuity, which you can see with the just hysteria that has stemmed from the kind of international financial institutions and the bourgeois press in response to Trump's talk of tariffs. And also, there has just been the continued implementation of neoliberal policies. So, for Trump, that was most obviously seen last year with the rewriting of the tax code, where he cut corporate taxes from 35 to 21%, with the top 1% of... That's a bit useless. I have a little piece of paper here if you can see that. That's the top fifth of the American economy, and you can see 70% of the benefits have gone there. And then within that, the top 1% received 34% of the benefits. Also, there has been pushing ahead right around the world to continue signing new free trade deals. Now the TPP is still being pushed, whether America is part of it or not. Also, the European leaders have been scrambling to save the EU and have managed to actually push back a bunch of potential challenges over the past couple of years. And despite getting a pretty rough ride in a series of elections, the kind of political centre has shown a pretty remarkable effort to actually hang on. So it might not be through the old parties necessarily, but the politics have. And I think Macron, the kind of neoliberal wonder boy in France, is a good example of that. But I think that this is it's in a large part due to the lack of an organised and sustained working class resistance. So the resistance that we have seen so far has been brief, so things like single mass rallies or movements that last a couple of months and then start to die down, or it's been expressed electorally. So unlike the 1970s, trade union membership and the strike rate are at historic lows. There's also just now a whole generation of workers with virtually no living memory of striking. And as it stands, no insurgent challenge to the right-wing leadership of the union movement. But again, you know, that is not something that is necessarily set in stone. Again, reference back to West Virginia. So far, the ruling class have not been forced into a position where they fear that they will lose their whole system unless there is some sort of dramatic shift. All right, well, in short, I think that what neoliberalism has just been a relentless class attack on workers right across the world. But we are now in a phase where the status quo is being challenged. We have a new period that is becoming increasingly characterised by crisis and instability. And I think the only way or the only path out of this, which is in the benefit of all of us rather than the global 1%, is to really reconstruct an anti-capitalist movement, anti-capitalist organisations that are actually able to face and win the new challenges that are being presented.